Crisco's radio newspaper with Bernardine Flynn, brought to you by the makers of Crisco. And now, here's Bernardine Flynn.
Thank you, Ed, and hello, everyone. This is the day for which we've all been waiting. D-Day, invasion of Western Europe. To millions of people in the occupied countries, this is the beginning of their liberation, after many long years of domination by Hitler and the Axis. Of course, we all want to hear the latest details. And in order that we might bring you as much invasion news as possible, Crisco is dropping its usual commercial time. Now let's switch to the New York headquarters of CBS World News for a report by Alan Jackson, one of Columbia's news editors.
Briefly, the situation at the moment is this. We have landed, and from all indications, have things well in hand. Most of the details as to exactly what's going on come from the Germans, because, naturally, our commanders are going to use utmost caution in releasing information which the enemy might not have. However, Admiral Ernest King, the commander of the United States fleet, said this morning in Washington after a conference with President Roosevelt that, from his viewpoint, the invasion of Europe is doing all right so far. The grand assault on the continent, as a matter of fact, was scheduled for yesterday, but it was postponed until today because of bad weather. When it did get underway early this morning, shortly after midnight, it found the highly vaunted German defenses much less formidable in every department than had been feared. For instance, airborne troops who led the assault before daylight on a history-making scale suffered extremely small losses in the air, even though the great plane fleets extended across 200 miles of sky and used navigation lights to keep formation. Naval losses for the seaborne forces are described as very, very small, although 4,000 ships and several thousand smaller craft took part in transporting the American, Canadian, and British troops to France. Coastal batteries were virtually silenced by the guns of the British, American, and Allied fleets, including battleships, and the beachheads were speedily consolidated. The German radio says the scene of the landings was a 100-mile stretch of the coast from Cherbourg to Le Havre. Britain's Prime Minister Churchill, announcing the successful invasion of the House of Commons at noon, 6 hours after the first seaborne troops had landed, said the landings were the first of a series. And then later on, he said that heavy fighting was taking place in the town of Caen, which is about 10 miles inland. Berlin admits that the invaders have succeeded in sending landing barges into two estuaries that are behind the Atlantic Wall, that great line of defenses which Hitler has talked about so much in the last couple of years or so. The Germans admit that Allied tanks have cut their way inland several miles between the towns of Caen and Isigny, two French towns about 35 miles apart. And, still according to the enemy, our troops have made penetrations ranging up to 10 miles. Thousands of Allied paratroopers, some reports say at least 20,000, landed behind the enemy lines to disrupt the German supply and communication facilities. These landings were most successful. And the Navy was on hand, too, the biggest armada in anybody's history. Surprisingly, the early reports say, as we just told you, the first resistance was comparatively light. Our casualties have been light so far. Correspondents flying in air squadrons overhead reported our troops splashing ashore against only little resistance. The airborne troops, the soldiers who crossed over the enemy land in air transports and gliders, have encountered only slight resistance so far. But this should not be taken as an indication of things to come. Quite the contrary. While it's true that the going seems to have been fairly easy so far, it'll get tougher later on. The Germans, for instance, are holding huge reserves of troops behind the lines, waiting to see where the Allies will hit the hardest. When that fact is determined, the enemy high command will order everything in his power into the attack. Thus, the job of our paratroopers and airborne forces is to blow up the bridges, the highways, and the railroads over which the enemy reserves would have to move to counter our main blow. This enemy blow may come in a day. It may come next week sometime. But when it does come, it will be the enemy's supreme attempt to knock a damaging hole in our invading armies. And the fighting will be tough. General Eisenhower calls the invasion a crusade, and he says that nothing less than full victory can come of it. Early this morning, just a short while after the first official announcement of the invasion had been made, Eisenhower made a special broadcast to the underground fighters of the occupied countries. He warned them against any premature uprising, but he urged them to complete their preparations and to stand ready for the signal. And that signal, it is expected, will touch off the greatest revolt in history. Estimates place the size of these underground armies at something like 8 million men. 8 million men armed and waiting to strike back at the people who have held them in subjugation for so many years. Well, perhaps it might be a good idea now to take a look at the geography, that is, the land at which the Allied armies are striking today. General Eisenhower's invasion hit the Atlantic Wall in the sector of the lowest French coastline, the widest beaches, avoiding the heavily fortified cliffs opposite Dover, upon which the Germans had planted naval guns, which command the narrow straits of Dover at the eastern entrance to the channel. Caen, apparently, is the center of the first attack by airborne parachute troops. That's a key point on the water-level roads and railroads to Paris, which is barely 120 miles away, since its capture, that is, the capture of Caen, would force a German evacuation, hastily, of the whole Cherbourg Peninsula. So far as the geography of the French coast is concerned, the Allied High Command picked for its initial attack a sector giving the Allied forces the most favorable terrain. Except for the coastline east of Le Havre, toward Dieppe, where there are high, steep cliffs, the whole seafront under attack is flat and sandy. Cherbourg lies at the foot of a cliff, with the city and port at water level, but with the fortifications and airfield on a high plateau on the cliff, dominating the city from the south. It always was considered one of the best fortified and strongest defended of the French Channel ports. Le Havre lies at the mouth of the Seine, the natural gateway to Paris. The Havre port, once the terminal of the Normandy and many other great transatlantic liners, is the biggest port on the French North Shore. It was under frequent air attack during 4 years of occupation, but unless the Germans dynamite its locks in their defense or retreat, it may be found fairly intact upon the entry of American troops. One of the first coastal villages attacked and flown over by airborne troops was Bur-sur-Mer, the fishing village where Admiral Richard E. Byrd and his crew made a forced landing at the conclusion of their transatlantic flight in June 1927. Prime Minister Churchill told the House of Commons, when he went to the address this morning, that the invasion was proceeding according to plan. Then, with emphasis, he added, "What a plan." President Roosevelt spent the early mornings of the invasion day writing a prayer for victory for the armed forces, and he will broadcast this prayer to the world at 10 o'clock tonight. He has expressed the hope that the nation will join him in the prayer. In part of that, he says, "Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again, and with thy blessings we shall prevail over the unholy forces of the enemy." Mr. Roosevelt dispatched the prayer to the House by motorcycle messenger, and it was read on the floor shortly after Dr. James Sherrill Montgomery, the chaplain of the House of Representatives, departed from custom to ask members to join him in the opening invocation. Again the members stood, this time in silent prayer. At its conclusion, Minority Leader Martin of Massachusetts reminded his colleagues that many heartbreaking days lie ahead. During the morning, Mr. Roosevelt summoned the Army and Navy High Commands to the White House for his first personal conference with the commanders since troops began hitting the beaches during the night. The High Command personnel included General Marshall, the Army Chief of Staff, General Arnold, head of the Army's Air Forces, and Admiral King, Chief of Naval Operations. General Marshall appeared worn when he went to the conference, as though he had spent a sleepless night. Already throughout the nation, countless church services are being held. Many states and cities have issued special proclamations on D-Day. Britain's King George is scheduled to go on the air this afternoon at 3 o'clock with a special Invasion Day message. French General de Gaulle broadcast to the people of France at 11:30 this morning. Before that, King Haakon of Norway sent a special message to his people. And now General Wilhelm Hansteen, Commander-in-Chief of the Norwegian Underground, has broadcast an order to all organized fighting groups inside Norway to be prepared to take part in the Great Settlement. Well, that's the invasion news as it looks so far. I'll be back in a few minutes with a summary of developments today. And now back to Bernardine Flynn.
Thank you, Alan. That was Alan Jackson, one of Columbia's news editors in New York, bringing us the latest details on the invasion and how it's been going since early this morning. If any later bulletins should come in while we're on the air, we'll bring them right to you. Recently, General Eisenhower prepared the underground of Europe for D-Day. A member of his staff told the downtrodden people to learn to recognize his voice, which was to bring them directions and instructions daily.
And now that voice from Supreme Headquarters has announced to them and to the world that D-Day, H-Hour, has arrived.
Yes, Ed, and already the underground is secretly at work disrupting every enemy defense and troop movement possible. They are cutting communications, dynamiting bridges and viaducts, opening dams, destroying power lines and railroads.
And I understand the French underground numbers more than 1 million people.
That's right. It's a force which began as a guerrilla unit, and today it's virtually a corps of sabotage engineers. It's made up of many officers and men of the disbanded French army. men from all walks of life, all creeds and political beliefs. Most of the officers are Army men, and many of its fighters have fought the Germans in two wars. There are also thousands of boys in the green uniforms of the youth labor camps who have chosen to join the underground rather than to go back to Germany as conscripts.
You know, it's certainly amazing the way members of the underground have been able to feed themselves and gather information so secretly.
Usually they are fed by their friends, and many times they gather food from isolated farms and villages. Planes flying over from London have delivered arms and explosives to them, as well as printing material and other supplies. Coded messages have kept the underground informed as to when these planes fly over.
And every message and instruction to these men has had to be safeguarded with an enormous amount of care. One misunderstood direction could mean disaster. For instance, for many months, our own men have been preparing for this invasion. It's taken weeks and weeks to assemble ships to carry them, planes to support their landings, ammunition and food. But tons of material could be lost through a single careless accident.
How true that is, Ed. While thousands of planes are necessary, it's still more important that one plane with a wide-awake pilot with the right guns and ammunition be in the right spot at the right moment.
Exactly. A misread photograph, a road that must be open but is crowded with refugees, or even an open porthole on a ship are all invasion risks. The shine can be taken off helmets and the metal parts of guns, but there's no way of making sure that one or the other might not strike by chance against a landing boat shield and set off a spark to alert the enemy ashore. These are all things which couldn't be figured out on paper ahead of time. And yet they're things on which the very success of this second front depends.
Ed, and let's take our visitors on an imaginary visit over the English countryside where the chief of our invasion forces spent his hours working and planning every detail of this second front.
General Eisenhower lived for a while in London, didn't he?
Yes, he did, but some time ago he moved out to a six-room cottage in the country. The general was up every morning by 5 or 6 o'clock. Each morning before breakfast, he puttered around the garden for a little while and then read the newspapers. But by 8 o'clock, he'd had his breakfast and was in his office hard at work.
An office completely surrounded with maps and important documents, I should imagine.
Yes, and with many pictures. Pictures of his family and of the Allied leaders of the world. One of the pictures is from President Roosevelt. There is also one from Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. The inscription is in Chinese. You were speaking of documents, Ed. One of the most important of these is the shortest. It is the president's cable to Stalin informing him of Eisenhower's appointment as commander-in-chief of the Western Front Invasion Force.
And that room has contained countless secrets which the Germans had sacrificed many divisions to learn.
It is a rectangular room with a big fireplace and two small tables and a large walnut desk in a corner between two windows. On the wall, there is an enormous map of Europe. In this office, the general has worked 7 days a week on invasion plans. And now, friends, let's switch back to the New York newsroom to see if any late details have come in since we last heard from Alan Jackson.
There have been few really late details on the invasion in the last few minutes. However, here is a brief summary of the way the invasion news looks right now. The British Ministry of Supply says that many secret weapons never before used are being employed by the invading Allied troops. In Washington, Admiral King, commander of the United States fleet, says that in his viewpoint, the invasion is doing all right so far. General Marshall, the Army Chief of Staff, says, "I can't make any statement." And to newsmen there, he said, "You know all about it." Allied headquarters in England reveals that the invasion was scheduled for a day earlier, but was postponed because of bad weather. A dispatch from London quotes the German DNB news agency as saying that the invasion front has further widened in the past few hours. Prime Minister Churchill, as you know, has said that heavy fighting is taking place in the town of Caen, about 10 miles inland from the French coast. And that's the invasion news to this minute.
Thank you again, Alan. Well, friends, the liberation of Western Europe is underway. Alan Jackson, one of Columbia's news editors, has supplied us with the latest news on this greatest of all military operations. It can't be repeated too often. The fighting that lies ahead will be extremely bitter. Let's all offer up a prayer for victory.
That, friends, ends another edition of Crisco's Radio Newspaper. Join us again tomorrow at this same time. Until then, this is Ed Roberts.
And Bernardine Flynn saying goodbye for the makers of Crisco.
We return you now to New York.
This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.